From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is
War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Kate Aronoff.
This week on War News Radio, Voices of Influence, we hear about Muqtada al-Sadr's recent visit to Iraq.
Then we talk to an author about moral panic before the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Finally, we hear about Iraqi refugees in Syria.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraq's highest court issued a decision placing several government bodies under the control of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Previously independent institutions such as the Central Bank and the Electoral Commission will now be overseen by the Prime Minister's cabinet. The ruling has drawn sharp criticism from politicians across the political spectrum. Opponents denounce the decision as a power grab by al-Maliki. Opposition to the ruling from members of al-Maliki's own coalition underline the divisions within the Iraqi government.
Egypt has arrested 19 people en route to Iraq suspected to be affiliated with al-Qaeda. Egypt's interior minister stated they were attempting to join the Islamic State of Iraq, an insurgency group. The minister also said that weapons and ammunition were taken from the suspects.
President Hamid Karzai approved the opening of Afghanistan's parliament this week. Karzai had previously refused to open the legislature until allegations over voting fraud from last September's elections were resolved. Ultimately, pressure from members of parliament forced Karzai to inaugurate the new lawmakers. However, the president has not abandoned plans to establish a special court to evaluate the legitimacy of last year's elections, despite claims from opposing politicians that a new tribunal would be unconstitutional.
Arnold Fields, Inspector General for Reconstruction in Afghanistan, testified before the Congressional Commission on Wartime Contracting this week. Fields explained that U.S. plans to build bases for Afghan forces are behind schedule. The lack of infrastructure calls into question the ability of Afghan forces to maintain security after the planned U.S. withdrawal in 2014. Currently, only 133 bases have been completed out of the 884 bases planned. Over $11 billion have been allocated to this project.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced a partnership with Sheikh Mohammed, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, to immunize children in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Bill Gates and Sheikh Mohammed have each pledged $50 million to the effort. Two-thirds of the money will be used to purchase vaccines for the most common killers of Afghan children. The partnership is one of the first initiatives of its kind in the Middle East. Currently, one in four Afghan children dies before his or her fifth birthday.
Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, has contacted the president about a proposal to further increase the size of Afghan security forces. The senator recently returned from a trip to Afghanistan, Yemen, and Iraq. He and other U.S. lawmakers support a proposal to increase the Afghan police and military forces by 78,000. They argue that an increase in Afghan forces will allow for an earlier withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, a process set to begin in July of 2011. The proposal also has the support of General David Petraeus and Defense Secretary Robert Gates. However, the plan will cost the U.S. another $6 billion next year if put into place, twice the amount initially allocated.
A federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit filed by the families of four murdered American civilian contractors against Blackwater USA, the controversial private security firm now known as Z-Services. The employees were killed in 2004 in Fallujah while working as military security contractors. The incident gained significant attention after graphic images of the men's murders were broadcast around the world. The workers' families sued Blackwater for sending the men into Fallujah without proper protections, such as armored cars. Employee contracts with Blackwater require that disputes must be resolved through arbitration. The judge threw out the case on the grounds that the families could not pay the required fees.
Another pending Blackwater case made progress this week. A federal judge ruled that the case regarding the shooting of Iraqi civilians by Blackwater employees must proceed in North Carolina State Court. Blackwater had previously argued that its employees could not be prosecuted under U.S. law because they were serving the U.S. government in a theater of war.
A former InnoSpec CEO has paid $229,000 to settle SEC charges of bribing Iraqi and Indonesian officials. Paul Jennings was accused of approving bribes in order to win Iraqi chemical contracts. His company, InnoSpec, has already paid $40 million in fines last year to settle related bribery charges. The illegally obtained contracts allowed Innospec to boost sales of toxic fuel additives banned in Western countries. Jennings has denied any wrongdoing.
President Obama's third State of the Union address focused little on Iraq and Afghanistan. He devoted a single paragraph to each nation that reaffirmed his commitment to ending the wars and a scheduled withdrawal. The majority of his speech focused on revitalizing the American economy.
In 2007, the Iraqi national soccer team won the Asia Cup despite being a heavy underdog. The tournament, held every 4 years, started again on January 7th. Ahmed Thamer, a medical student at Baghdad University, had high hopes for the team.
I'm so excited about it. I hope that we win this game and we earned the cup again, like we did in 2007.
Iraq made it out of the group stage with wins over the United Arab Emirates and North Korea, with a loss to Iran. Thamer says the team had the nation buzzing with Iraqi pride.
All of Iraqis, Kurdi, Arabi, Sunni, Shi'i, all of them watching this team, because we are so proud of this team, and this team represents the unity of the Iraqi, of the Iraq. When they win again, you can see that all the Iraqi people, no differences between them, go to the streets and celebrate. No care about the bombs, no care about anything. Just to celebrate and be happy.
Unfortunately for their fans, in the quarterfinals, the Iraqi national team lost to Australia 1-0 in extra time.
This is War News Radio. January has been bloody in Iraq this year. Over 85 Shiite pilgrims have been killed while marching to Karbala for the recent holiday of Arba'in. Other attacks have also rocked the country. Amid the strife, one of the most divisive characters of the U.S. involvement in Iraq returned to the country. Sam Hirschman has more on the political implications of his visit.
Influential Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has opposed American intervention in Iraq since the invasion of 2003. Al-Sadr, the spiritual leader of the Mahdi army, led his followers in an armed resistance against U.S. forces and the Iraqi government until he ordered most of his forces to disarm in 2008. In 2007, al-Sadr fled to Iran. Last year, while in voluntary exile, he played an important role in the formation of Iraq's new government. In a recent speech captured by Reuters, al-Sadr and his followers proclaimed, "No, no, America." On January 5, 2011, al-Sadr returned to Iraq for the first time in over 3 years. Although al-Sadr went back to Iran again on January 21st, his return to Iraq sparked varying analyses of his influence on Iraqi politics. Some analysts say he's a threatening force with a strong influence on the future of Iraq. Others disagree, saying that his power is significantly limited. Ahmed Thamer, a medical student at Baghdad University, remembers al-Sadr for his role in sectarian violence.
Muqtada al-Sadr is a leader of a terrorist gang that caused harmful sequences to the Iraqi people, including Shia and Sunni. No difference between them. Of course, its return to Iraq, its effect on people have little effect, because people here are not scared if he returns or he is not. All the Iraqi people, what we need is to live in peace.
Recently, al-Sadr has voiced support for the new Iraqi government, and his party's members of parliament were among the first to join the coalition. This has led some commentators to believe he has strong political influence. Mohammed Bazzi, a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, says al-Sadr came back to Iraq to demonstrate his power.
Well, there was something of a victory lap after he had played this role as kingmaker in ending the months of political paralysis.
On the other hand, John Scott Carpenter, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, does not think al-Sadr has as much influence as it might look.
Politically, he's not as strong as people think he is. If you look at the electoral results, in Maliki, for instance, in Baghdad, got more votes himself as one individual than Muqtada al-Sadr's list got in total. So he's not that strong. He's still remembered as having created a great deal of strife in the south, in Basra and other provinces in the south. He still has pockets of support in Baghdad, where most of his support came from in the last elections. But he's not a tremendously strong political force.
Bazzi says what al-Sadr has done is lead a very disciplined movement.
And his supporters in the Sadr movement really played the political game very well in Iraq, both with the parliamentary elections in 2010, but also with the earlier provincial elections in 2009, and the alliances he was able to create, and the sort of political work that the movement was able to create on the ground in both elections was very significant.
Carpenter agrees that al-Sadr's movement could gain significant power on a more local level.
Groups like Muqtada al-Sadr's can take advantage of disillusionment in the provinces for this lack of service delivery and push for more autonomy.
But Ahmed Sayyid, a student at the University of Technology in Baghdad, doesn't believe al-Sadr will win over the Iraqi people.
And the people would not support any leaders that
And the people will not support any leader that leads the people to death and makes the people's situation worse.
Make the people's situation worse.
Both Thamer and Sayyid think the government and country are getting stronger. Sayyid says it is only a matter of time.
It's getting better day after day.
It's getting better day after day, and the government is getting better. I think we need time.
I think we need time.
If the new government, formed with al-Sadr's support, is not capable of keeping the country secure and providing basic services, Carpenter says al-Sadr is positioned to gain in power and influence.
Muqtada al-Sadr can be a factor because he's being very smart right now. He's saying, look, I'm supportive, I'm in, but. And I think he's banking on the fact that this government is going to fail to deliver services. And so if the government fails to do it, then I think he's going to be waiting in the wings.
But for now, al-Sadr has returned to Iran, ostensibly to finish his religious studies. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. In a new book titled Moral Panic, Mass Deception and the U.S. War in Iraq, Scott Bond, a professor of sociology at Drew University, examines how public support for the war in Iraq was created. Bond argues that the Bush administration knowingly deceived the American public into believing Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. In his book, Bond examines the role the Bush administration and the news media played in creating a moral panic. Kyle Crawford spoke with Professor Bond about his book. Here's their conversation.
So, Professor Bond, your book is called Mass Deception, Moral Panic in the U.S. War in Iraq. Can you explain for us what exactly moral panic means and how it relates to the war in Iraq?
there are times in history, moments in history, where it sometimes is in the best mutual interests of political elites, as well as the channels of mass communication, mass media, to essentially scare the heck out of people. And for the media, it gives them, of course, juicy stories and intrigue and reasons for people to tune in. And for the elites, they require and rely upon the channels of communication through the mass media.
So you write that the Bush administration created public support for the war by engineering a moral panic. And you show this by examining the rhetoric the administration used and examining public opinion polls. Could you just tell us a little bit about this?
Sure, absolutely. The moral panic concept, I should just say, had been applied typically to more localized situations, things like a school shooting or perhaps a satanic cult, a local satanic cult, or sometimes even a serial killer situation that gets blown out of proportion and then generalized as a threat to the entire population. I believe that I'm the first to do two things, Kyle. One is to apply the moral panic concept to a much larger and even international event like a war. And then secondarily, I'm the first, I believe, to actually look at an empirical analysis or a statistical analysis. So to get to your specifically to your question, what I did is I looked at the Bush administration's rhetoric over time and how it evolved, and the rhetoric, I mean, specifically toward Iraq. And, for example, shortly after 9/11, the new terminology was being used by the administration, and specifically in regards to Iraq. Things like evildoers, madmen, weapons of mass destruction, axis of evil, things like that. And I looked at this rhetoric in the media as disseminated by the Bush administration, and as it became ever more inflammatory and as the volume of the rhetoric increased in the media, and how that in turn then influenced public opinion and the public's willingness to go to war as measured in Gallup public opinion polls. And I did this over a 3-year period. And it was almost just like a crescendo. As the volume of the rhetoric and as the inflammatory nature of it increased, Kyle, then public opinion just mirrored it. And to the point where by March 19th of 2003, which was the day the invasion began, about 70% of the public not only approved of going to war, but 70% of the public also believed that Iraq had been involved in the events of 9/11, the attacks of 9/11, and that they did in fact have these massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction that the Bush administration alleged, but of course was not true.
Now you place a lot of support to the idea that generally, people can have their opinions swayed by the news media. Now, do you think this is the case, or do you think you're underestimating the intelligence of people on the whole?
I would lean toward the latter. I'm very influenced by the work of Noam Chomsky and his seminal work, Manufacturing Consent, and also some of the writings of scholars out of the Frankfurt School of Social Research in Frankfurt, Germany. And what these individuals are really arguing is that in many ways, oppression in modern society and in capitalist societies, it no longer requires a gun to the head or a club. That rhetoric itself and the dissemination of rhetoric and propaganda through the media, which may seem benign and may even be served up in very attractive sound bites, can actually be extremely manipulative.
So for people who might not know, you were an executive at NBC before you went into academia. How does this, if at all, affect the way you approach your scholarship and the ideas you present in your book?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, if I hadn't spent that time in the belly of the beast, so to speak, or you know, in the corporate media world, I probably wouldn't even be asking some of the questions that I do, Kyle. It was my exposure and seeing how important advertisers are and how powerful advertisers are in terms of setting the standards and determining what gets on the air and what does not, that made me realize that that the notion of freedom of the press and freedom of the media is really much more of an illusion than a reality. And so, without a doubt, my time spent in the media and advertising world affected the way I look at things and affected my the very questions that I ask.
So recent polls about the war in Iraq show that most Americans oppose the war and want U.S. forces to leave the country. How can the conclusions that you come to in your book be applied to the fact that there's this waning support for the war?
Well, I think there's a couple of questions there. I think the overall statement or message of my book is let's not get fooled again. We were sold a bill of goods, or at least 70% of the U.S. population was sold a bill of goods about the threat of Iraq, and it turned out that nothing that that the public was told was true. So there's one message there, which is be very careful before you drink the tainted Kool-Aid of elites. Make sure that you look at what their underlying motivations might be. Why are they serving it up in the first place? That's certainly one message, but there's also the reason that the population has turned both in toward the Iraq war, and even recently you may have noticed, Kyle, that the approval ratings for the war in Afghanistan are also at an all-time low. I believe the population is simply saying, why are we there? You know, why are we there in the first place? What are we accomplishing? Both the Iraqi population as well as the Afghan population, the vast majority of citizens in both countries want the U.S. and NATO troops out, and actually in both countries, the population, at least a sizable portion of both populations, believes that it's just fine and acceptable to use violence against the U.S. troops in order to get them to leave their countries. So, you know, it really begs the question, you know, what are we doing? Why are we there?
This is War News Radio. As violence and sectarian conflict took hold of Iraq in the years after the U.S. invasion, many Iraqis fled their homes for safer destinations, both inside and outside the country. The exodus dramatically altered the makeup of many Iraqi towns and neighborhoods, but the refugees also changed the color of the places they moved to. Jerimana, a mainly Christian and Jewish neighborhood of Damascus, is home to many displaced Iraqis. In this piece, first aired in March of 2009, Gabriel Ramirez has more on what the war has meant for this neighborhood and its residents.
Wasim is a young Iraqi Christian. He tells us his story from the footsteps of a local internet cafe. I am from Iraq. I lived in Baghdad. I arrived here in July of 2007. They were trying to kill me, so I left my home and came here.
Wasim lives on the outskirts of Damascus, Syria, in the neighborhood of Jerimana. He is one of the estimated 16,000 Iraqi refugees living there. The perils of the war in Iraq have caused the largest exodus of people in the region since the creation of Israel. But this time, people aren't moving to refugee camps. Dr. Omar Diwachi, a social anthropologist who is researching Iraqi refugees, tells us how the current crisis is unique.
It has not concentrated in camps and not concentrated in very overt spaces deemed as refugee camps or considered as spaces for foreigners who are living there. It has been a flux into urban settings.
Jerimana, a mainly Christian and Jews working class neighborhood, has become an economically viable place for fleeing Iraqis. The percentage of Iraqis living there has become so high that the town has taken an Iraqi flavor. A Syrian entrepreneur living in the area describes how he feels walking in the streets.
In Jerimana, there are more Iraqi restaurants than Syrian restaurants. Even Syrian restaurants serve Iraqi foods. Also, sometimes when you walk in the street, you hear only the Iraqi accent.
Wasim also says he feels the same way. One feels like he is in Baghdad. In Baghdad, there's a circle where everybody is a Syrian Christian like me. Many of them are here now, just like in Baghdad. But what makes Jeremana a selling point for many Iraqis is its diversity and tolerance. Jeremana is home to various religions and peoples. Druze, Muslims, Christians of many sects all live together there, relatively free from social pressures. A Syrian entrepreneur from the area tells us how he sees the neighborhood.
There is social and religious freedom here. The people that are running from prejudice come to Jeremana. In Jeremana, there are people of all types. There is no specific sect here.
For more secular Iraqis, Jeremana is a place where they can practice their beliefs without social pressures. Dr. Diwachi tells us one reason why his family moved to Jeremana.
It was more, I guess, reminiscent of, let's say, Baghdad, kind of middle-class neighborhoods. My extended family, they wanted for the woman to at least go out and walk in the street wearing or not wearing the hijab. Men, you know, wanted to be living in a place where there is no religious pressure or political pressure on them.
Jeremana also serves as a place for Iraqis who are fed up with the sectarian and religious violence caused by the war.
So you find Christians and Muslims and Mandians and, you know, hanging out all together. And I think a place like Jeremana has definitely provided this possibility that probably in Iraq, if these different families and different friends were living in different neighborhoods, it was much more difficult to do during the last few years.
But Jeremana isn't perfect. Both Iraqis and Syrians are suffering from the overcrowding, which is causing a spike in the prices of commodities and housing. Many Iraqis living there hope that their time in Jeremana is only a transition. Some are hoping to travel to Europe or to the U.S. Others, like Wasim, are waiting for the war to end.
God willing, I'll return to Iraq when the situation settles. Maybe when I return, things will be like before, or better. But right now, I can't. It's too difficult.
For now, Wasim and other Iraqis will continue to call Jeremana their home. For War News Radio, I'm Gabriel Ramirez. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Alan Zhao, Louis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Robert Halauka, Emily Bryan, Eliana Biscar Church, Angelica Dombey, Amandine Lee, Aaron Moser, and our producer, Jim McMillan. I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Kate Aronoff. Until next time, thanks for listening.